Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hey everybody, it's 2 off the 1st. It's January 5th, 2024. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thanks for being here. It's Friday. Hope you have a great weekend planned, whether that's watching golf from Hawaii, whether that's watching playoff football, whether that's doing something else that isn't watching something on TV. I don't know what that's like. But anyway, my son and daughter have their first basketball games this weekend, and I'm very excited to go watch that for both of them. So whatever you're doing, hopefully it's a great weekend. Anyway, we've got some stuff to talk about here today. We do have a live thing, but we also, I want to kind of get into what happened in the first round of the Century. I want to call it the Century Tournament of Champions, but it's not that. It's not that at all. It's the Century. And I want to talk a little bit about that, and then a touch on that, and then I want to talk about this very strange story that Doug Ferguson from the Associated Press reported. So let's start with everything being presented by our friends at Swannies. Check them out, swannies.co. Check out their jackets, their pullovers, their quarter zips. They're beautiful, great color blocks, lots of different materials, all kinds of cool prints. Their hoodies are incredible. Get 25% off your first order at swannies.co, swannies.co. Golf News Net 25 is the promo code. All right, so let's set the table a little bit for at least the first round of the tournament. Once again, the Kapalua Plantation Course, which is a par 73. It's the only par 73 on the PGA Tour. It got dominated. It got just beat up by these players. And in the last few years, the winning score of this tournament has been 30-ish under par, except for the 1 year I think Justin Thomas won. He won at like 24 under. And even if you made this golf course a par 71 and you took 8 strokes away from the field relative to par, par doesn't matter, it's a construct. No, none of that really matters. But if you took those 8 strokes away, you would still have guys playing in the low to mid 20s under par most years in this event. So it's just the way that it's just an easier golf course for professionals. There's really not a lot to challenge them. I mean, the fairways are enormous. The greens are huge. There are some things that can cause pain and damage and bogeys and, you know, squares on the card, but not a whole lot. So Sahith Theegala winds up shooting 9 under par 64. He takes the first round lead. And then just behind him, who played earlier, you have Colin Morikawa, who was a great play. Camilo Villegas, who wouldn't have even been in this event really before the Butterfield Bermuda, right? That win got him into this because winners still get in here, but also the top 50 in the FedEx Cup from last year, eligible players. And he's at 8 under par. You got Sungjae Im, who made a kind of middle of the round run to get into contention, so he's 8 under. You got Jason Day, who's now wearing Malbon Golf, unironically, on the tour. And he's wearing clothes that look like they're out of my closet from 2002. And you've got Victor Hovland, who shot one of the quietest 865s you'll probably ever see. And those are the guys that are tied for second. 2 strokes back, you got a whole other lineup of 5 players. You have Scottie Scheffler, who, again, another very quiet 66. Jordan Spieth, 66. Emiliano Grillo, 66. Patrick Cantlay, 66. Xander Schauffele, 66. So if you listen to our golf betting podcast, The Press, most of those guys, I told you, were going to play well. I wouldn't have said Camilo, and I don't think I said Jason Day, but everyone else pretty much put them on the list. And then from a personal perspective, I have some money on Sepp Straka to win at like 60-1 or something like that. He's 3 back of the lead, so he's playing pretty well. But somehow his odds got worse, which I think is kind of incredible. Anyhow, so that's the first round. Scoring's very good, and I always kind of look at, especially in these limited field events, at the bottom of the leaderboard, not to be mean or, you know, any kind of schadenfreude, but just to kind of understand where the cutoff from having a chance is, especially after the first round. And I would tell you, like, 6 shots back is the cutoff, probably. I mean, it probably isn't. It's really more like four shots back. But you can go very low on this course very quickly. So I would say there are 45 players in the field. There are three under or better. Those are the ones that probably have a chance. And then beyond that, you know, you have 14 players that really don't have a chance. And three players shot even par or worse: Vincent Norman, Andrew Putnam, and Cam Davis. Someone a lot of people liked pre-tournament, including myself, by the way, but that I talked myself out of. And those guys, you know, have no chance of winning once you're over par in this tournament. Justin Rose had a weird penalty. He hit the wrong ball, so he had to take a penalty. Otherwise, he would be in that group at three under or better. But, you know, most of the field's still in this after day one. It was really great to see again. Everything was lovely. The views were awesome. There was some wind. That was cool. I don't mean that in a weather joke way. I mean, this golf course is more interesting when the wind blows, even if they're still destroying it, because you got to hit some different shots. Scottie Scheffler hit a stinger of a drive that probably got 30 feet off the ground. The shot tracer said like 40 feet. I don't even think it was that. I think it was 30 feet off the ground most. And just a beautiful drive to try to set up a way to get into the hill. And then it didn't wind up working out. Still rolled well left into the rough on this short par four. But that was the shot he wanted to hit to stay in the fairway. And it was stuff like that that's really cool to see. And then one, like two shots on TV later, Sungjae Im's playing 17, which is a 560-yard par four because it's all downhill. He has 200 yards left. And they go, oh, yeah, he's probably hitting a 9-iron here, and then sticks it to like 6 feet. It's just a very different golf course than you see because of the undulation of the ground, obviously the views, the wind. It's just all different, and I like that. It's a great start to the year. So hopefully the intrigue continues tonight. I'm sure that it will. It's on 6 p.m. on Golf Channel. It's on, I believe, at 2:45 p.m. on ESPN Plus for PGA Tour Live. Yesterday they started at 12:45. I don't think they were doing that today, but not sure on that. So there's that. While all of this is happening, Jon Rahm is in Maui. He's there on vacation. And Doug Ferguson reports this for the Associated Press. Put it out yesterday. I saw it as a screen cap from Dylan DeCher, golf.com. Does a great job of his reporting. But Jon Rahm is in Maui, presumably with his wife and children. And they're just there on vacation. And I don't know why that is. I don't understand that. But apparently, according to Ferguson's reporting, at least a couple of players have spotted him out and about and kind of gone and talked to him. And the terminology used from Ferguson was that it was kind of chilly, you know, kind of awkward in terms of a reception. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I think that's emblematic. I mean, obviously it's a fresh wound, so to speak, because he's the latest guy to go to LIV Golf. But I find that fascinating that Rahm was like, I'm going to Maui for vacation. Well, what, I guess I'm going to step back and ask, was this planned? Maybe he wasn't going to sign. I mean, he did say the day he signed with LIV, December 6th, that he made the choice that day. So maybe he went ahead and booked a home for the Century in the event that he stayed, or a deal got worked out, or what have you. And I don't know, but if you just made that much money from LIV and you have it, I mean, you can line the walls of your house with $100 bills. Wouldn't you just kind of cancel that and be like, I don't think I need to be where my former, and maybe once again someday soon, co-workers are? That just strikes me as very strange. I don't think it was purposeful to kind of stick it to the guys who were playing the tournament. The only other thought that I could have is maybe he thought he was going to win PGA Tour Player of the Year and that he was going to pick up the award in Maui instead of... I don't even know how you would think that would go, because they wouldn't have that ceremony. They'd be like, just be like, John, you won. We're going to FedEx that package to you. Goodbye. Click. And they put out a release about it. And they did put a release out about who won. Scottie Scheffler won. They said he got 38% of the vote. There were three other contenders, Rahm Hovland and Wyndham Clark. Rahm Hovland, Scheffler, Wyndham Clark, and Rory McIlroy. So, you had this group, and the voting happened from December 1st through the 15th. Obviously, Rahm made his decision on the 6th, and so probably from that point on, everyone who voted said, we're not giving it to John Rahm, and they gave it to Scottie Scheffler instead. There's always kind of, when stuff like this happens, there's always a conspiracy theory abound that the tour changed the vote, or because they don't tell you how many players voted. They just tell you the percentage that players got, and not every player is compelled to vote. They don't have to vote. And not every player can vote. You have to play in 15 FedEx Cup events in that year. So if you played like five, you don't get a vote. So it's like our representative democracy. You have to, participate, or you don't have to participate, but if you do, then you count. And I guess that's how the tour chooses to do it. So we don't know how that all worked out or when the votes came in and all that stuff. But nevertheless, he wound up winning. Scheffler did a second consecutive PGA Tour Player of the Year award instead of Rahm, who did win the Masters and did win at Riviera and was great in the Ryder Cup. That's not really part of the voting. And after that, didn't have the best of years. Through April was great, and then you got through the rest of the way and it wasn't so good. Although he was a contender to win the B flight at the Open Championship, but Brian Harman ran away with that one. So I that is such an interesting detail to me, and I'm so curious why he was there or why he didn't cancel it. Because Maui is an island. And I know Hawaii's a state, but Maui's an island in a chain of islands. So it's not like there's a lot of space to run and hide. You're bound to run into somebody. But it is also big enough as an island that Rahm could also have gone completely undetected. So what it had to have been revolving around the tournament, and he couldn't cancel it or something, or it revolved around trying to get the PGA Tour Player of the Year award. Either way, very strange. And then add in, and this was from Tron Carter at No Laying Up, Todd Schuster, if you want to go by his real name. But Tron tweeted that the PGA Tour's rookie orientation that every first-year player has to go through, it's compulsory, is at the Sony Open in Hawaii, which is next week's tournament. And that's strange for a couple of reasons. One, they can't do it over Zoom. Two, it's in Hawaii. Why would you make people fly from wherever they live? And most players, most professional golfers these days tend to live in Florida or Arizona, maybe Texas, California. But those are kind of like your four big states. For any of those people, that's a haul. Even from California, that's a haul to get to Hawaii. And third, the Sony Open in Hawaii is traditionally oversubscribed because it's the first tournament of the year. It's in Hawaii. The purse is pretty good. The players like the course. So older players who have status want to come and play. They sign up. The players who are in the top 125 want to come and play, especially now that all of these regular season events have more meaning because they could get you potentially into the next signature event. So that means quite a bit, and there's no FedEx Cup points from the fall to start, give you a head start. So you got to get going now because 59 guys are playing an event where they're all going to get FedEx Cup points, and the winner gets 700 of them. So you're already way behind the eight ball. It's different now, even more so than it used to be, and that means basically, of the 30 Korn Ferry Tour graduates, and most of them are rookies, only like 13 or 14 of them have gotten in. None of the five guys that got a card through Q School got in. I don't know how many players from the DP World Tour that took up status from finishing in the top 10 got in. I haven't seen the final field list yet. So, and that gets decided this evening. But all that to say, You're required, and they're paying for your commercial transportation. They're paying for you to fly to Hawaii and back. But why do you have to have that meeting there? Why not wait until the American Express, which is the first mainland tournament? It's in California. A lot of the guys that are in this reshuffle group of rookies between Korn Ferry Tour grads and DP World Tour grads, so to speak, and guys that are in the maybe the 126 to 150 range that were, you know, not playing a lot of event. You know, they got it by conditional status happenstance, or guys that got out of Q school. Why not have it there? Just make it easier. Or more importantly, it's 2024, have a Zoom. All of that is very strange to me. I think it's very interesting. But those two things kind of combine together, make for some natural intrigue, I think. And hey, you know, whatever. But for Rom to kind of go that way is... I need more details about that, and we're probably not going to get them. I find that very interesting. All right, let's talk about the second story today. And this is a topic I've kind of been... we talked about this the other day, and then the a newsletter from the folks at the Fried Egg reiterated why, kind of underscored this enough for me that I feel like got to talk about it a little bit in this vein. When Rory McIlroy did his interview with the Stick to Football podcast and it came out, we talked about it on this show. I did an article on it on the website. But on this show, talked about it as not necessarily an about-face or a sudden change of heart. It was more him saying a lot of the things he said in slightly different ways. And if you, more importantly, listen to the whole thing, it sounds like he's a borderline forlorn. I mean, that he's not in a great place about all this, that he's just kind of exasperated with the whole thing and doesn't like where things are, but has come to accept that 2 years into this, it's not done yet, although it might be, and that this is just kind of what happened. So, all, you know, makes all the comments, the aggregators, obviously I aggregated it, but we talked about it in depth here, and they put out the quotes, too judgmental, you know, I feel bad, and blah, 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 but then you get this response from Phil Mickelson, who's like, oh, it took a lot for Rory McIlroy to say what he said, and I really appreciate that, and we just kind of like to get things back together. The guy who, the arsonist, who started this whole thing, puts that out there, which I find absolutely insane. And then you have Greg Norman, who goes on Live Golf's podcast, which I can't believe Live Golf has a podcast, but they have a podcast, and it's called Fairway to Heaven, if you're interested. And Greg Norman appeared on it, and they talked about what McIlroy said. And Greg Norman makes it sound like McIlroy is showing some kind of fealty or respect to Liv, and what Liv's been doing and saying and acting and all that stuff. And honest, if you listen to what McIlroy said, it ain't that at all. It's more, he still hates Liv as a concept, and I'm pretty sure he wishes it never happened. But what he did say is he was too judgmental of players who took the money because they're not as rich as he is. Essentially, it's a weird flex of going, you know, maybe I was too judgmental because I'm so freaking loaded that these poors, relative poors, had to take the money, the Saudi money, and go to Live. And I was judgmental of them because they're poor. But I'm rich. And that's the lens through which it's set. It's not supposed to be a flex, but that's the way that you can interpret it. Nevertheless, so you have Norman go on this podcast, and I think Jerry Foltz is the host. I forget who the other... She works on the Lyft broadcast team, but I'm sorry, I forget her name at the moment. Anyhow, so here's what Norman says. Quote, I got to be honest with you. I'm very appreciative of what Rory said. It's been a painful couple of years. What we have done, meaning Liv, has been consistent. Our narrative has been consistent. Our delivering mechanism has been consistent. The reason I say I appreciate Rory to fall on his sword to some degree is the fact that he did judge us by not knowing the facts. He judged us on other people's thoughts and opinions. We wanted to sit down from day one with them to completely make them understand the value of the Live Footprint business model and the impact it can make on the game of golf. I say, hey, thank you, Rory. We all knew it was going to work within the golf ecosystem. We all want to be there. We are going to be there. He said that. To me, this is a significant turning point for everybody. I don't think Greg Norman heard the interview, if I'm being honest with you. I don't think he listened to it. He probably read some pool quotes, pick your pool quote article of choice, and went with that. And he just assumed the tone was a mea culpa instead of a I'm tired of this crap kind of attitude. McIlroy has been unequivocal over the years, the last couple of years, in saying he wants Liv to go away, he thinks it stinks, and I want Greg Norman out of the job. And he has also indicated, as we said the other day, that a lot of his involvement in this started because Greg Norman called him a puppet of the PGA Tour. And he's like, oh, I'm going to F him up, and went with that. He didn't judge people by not knowing the facts. He knew what was going on. He's not stupid. He also didn't judge people on, or judge the Liv guys on other people's thoughts and opinions. He judged them with his own mind made up. So this is a weird form of belittling from Greg Norman, who, by the way, is a tremendous anus. And this is Greg Norman to a T, of trying to shape something to fit his narrative. McIlroy has come this far not because someone's put a gun to his back or has puppet mastered him, but because he's wanted to do it. He's wanted to put this stuff out there. Now, he's gotten tired of it because it's been a long time. Two, he has other business interests. Three, June 6th happened, so then that changed everything. And four, he knows the deal's almost done. And I think the undertone from what McIlroy was saying, other than he's exasperated by all of this, is the recognition that a deal is at hand, might be done, might not be done, but it's close, and that it's almost certain to happen, and that all knowledge in hand means we don't kind of have to talk about it with the same fiery undertones anymore, because everyone's tired of it. Everyone's tired of talking back and forth. They just want to get a deal done. And I think everyone at this point wants to get something figured out, and it's just a matter of when and the order in which it happens. So I don't understand where Norman's coming from here. I almost never understand where Norman's coming from, because I think he's a poor representative of what Liv could have been. And I honestly think if someone else had steered the ship, it might have gone a different way. But so many players have a disdain for Greg Norman that I think this got extended probably longer than it needed to be. Because McIlroy went and met with Yasser Al-Rumayyan a year ago, a little more than a year ago, 14 months ago. And he wanted to know what Al-Rumayyan wanted, what he wanted to accomplish. And then that set off a cascading set of discussions eventually that happened in secret and McIlroy didn't really know about, that resulted in the deal that blindsided him. So this notion that McIlroy was judging people without being informed, he went to the guy bankrolling it and talked to him. What are we doing here? So Norman is exasperating. I mean, honestly, the Saudi money piece of this is the biggest part of it. But if the Norman piece of this can just kind of be shut down again, I think it works better for everybody. Because something like this is enough to tick somebody off that they change course, if you want to take it personally. Should he? Should McIlroy? No, of course not. But you never know what's going to spark something. You never know what's going to trigger somebody in a tense situation, a tense negotiation. It's still tense. So, anyhow. All right, it's going to do it for us today and for the week. Only two of the first. Thanks so much for spending some time with me. I really appreciate it. The podcast has been growing. It's been cool to see that, so I'm very appreciative. If you want to get a hold of me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, on Twitter, Threads, X, Instagram, and Blue Sky @RyanBallen, GM1. YouTube and Facebook at Ryan Ballingy Golf. We'll have a couple videos coming out, doing some bag reviews, some fun stuff coming. And then the TV stuff is working on in the background. So hopefully some more announcements coming on that soon. But we'll be back next week. We'll talk about what happened in Hawaii. We'll get ready for the Dubai Invitational on the DP World Tour. We've got some more Hawaii golf on the PGA Tour. And we got the Champions coming up. So golf's coming back. Here we go. We'll see you next week. Thanks so much for listening. And talk to you next time on Two Off the First.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.